The Vintage Gamer, Show 2, Demon Lord, and Other Heritage Dwarf Star Games. Hello, and welcome to Episode 2 of The Vintage Gamer, a podcast dedicated to seeking out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. As you heard, the game that I'm going to be discussing this week is Demon Lord. But before I get into it, I, of course, have a few announcements. I got a little feedback from the previous podcast, and I want to answer at least one of them. Mark Johnson of Board Games To Go gave me a hard time about my commute, my terrible 10-minute commute. All right, I do have some sympathy for people who have 30 to 40 to 1-hour commutes. I used to have a 40-minute commute when I lived in Boston. Still, I would like to keep the 20-minute format. I'm willing to go up to 30 minutes if people really want it. I'd like to get some feedback on this, actually, how long people would like me to talk. I'm just assuming that 20 minutes is about a good time. As far as what I'm talking about, I'm still trying to get my feet wet with it. Right now, I'm trying to find the right balance between analysis and description. I'm tending to lean heavily towards description. It's just the way that I judge games. I have someone describe them to me, and then I can make some sort of judgment as to whether I might like it or not. And then after that, I can get their opinion of it. It's sort of balancing both of those things together. So, and again, this is something else I could use feedback on if you have a different opinion, if you'd like me to take a different approach. Feedback is, of course, appreciated. The games that I'm covering this week and next week are inspired by the feedback. So that makes a good segue into discussing the game. As I mentioned, the game is called Demon Lord. It was originally published in 1981 by Dwarf Star Heritage. It is a two-player microgame. And in this case, it's a little bit above the normal quality for a microgame. Usually a microgame comes in a plastic envelope with a rule booklet and a flat paper board, and usually a very thin sheet of cardstock for the counters, which you have to cut out. For the Dwarf Star line, Heritage decided to create a little bit better quality. It actually comes in a box, and it has a cardboard map, and it comes with die-cut counters on actual thick cardstock. But the general sentiment remains the same. It's an inexpensive game, and it is a war game. The theme of this game is the two players play either the forces of light or the forces of darkness. In this case, the forces of light are called the followers of Hosar, and the forces of darkness are the demons. It's fairly clear that this game is influenced by Lord of the Rings. One example is that there are neutral forces in the game, which I'll talk about in just a sec. One of the neutral forces is the Kingdom of Ula, and you roll a die to determine what the actual makeup of those forces are. Well, this kingdom can either be led by the Balron and have trolls and slave miners, or it can be led by the Dwarf King and have dwarven warriors for units. Clearly inspired by Moria there. And there are some other parallels, which you can find in other fantasy. The forces of light live in meadows and forest, and the forces of darkness live in the mountains and the hills. In addition to the two main forces, there are five neutral groups that players can try to apply to for alliances. So basically, you move your counters near one of these alliance groups, and you roll a die to determine whether you can actually ally with the group. And if you succeed, you can move them around as if they're your own pieces. Basically, these groups act as reinforcements. As part of looking at this game, I actually sat down and wrote down some of the general troop balance to get a sense of whether the game was pretty balanced between the two sides. I have to conclude that the game is pretty well balanced. The Hosar start out with 34 units, and the demons start out with 35. Now, the demons can call up more reinforcements than the Hosars can, so there is a bit of imbalance there, but I think the Hosar have more characters that they can use, which I'll talk about in a second. Another balancing factor is that the Hosar have an easier time setting up alliances. I don't mean that the die roll is easier. I mean that the Hosar start out closer to the neutral factions, and so it takes them less time to get there, and therefore more likely to make an alliance. I think between all of those, both sides seem pretty equal to me. As I mentioned, the units are broken into two different types. There's the first type, which is standard for war game, which is the troop units. They represent a collection of men which can be sent around the board and engage in actions. The other type of unit is a character unit, which represents one person. It's basically a hero unit, which adds certain bonuses in attacking and in movement. The gameplay works like a standard two-player war game. One player goes through a series of steps on their turn, and then the other player does basically the same thing on their turn. And there are five parts. On your turn, you start by moving your pieces. You can then invoke new units, which is basically you go to a temple, which is one of the locations on the board, and you can say, I want to call up, say, the Western Wizard. So you take a character to any Temple of Hosar and you make a die roll, and that determines whether you can actually invoke the Western Wizard. After you try to and possibly succeed in invoking one of these new units, then you fight any battles. And battles occur if you and your opponent have pieces on the same hex, and one of those units isn't actually fortified. After any battles are resolved, then you conduct sieges, which is the case where both players have pieces on one hex and one player has fortified their pieces. And finally, you try to make an alliance with one of the neutral factions, and you can only make one alliance attempt per turn. Okay, so I've covered, of those five phases, I've covered basically two of the pieces, which is invoking the new units and setting up alliances. Movement is pretty typical for war games. Basically, moving in open terrain is easier. There's blocking terrain for land units, and there are some winged units that you can use, and they can go pretty much anywhere they want. And unlike other war games that I've seen where the troop units move at their base movement all the time, in this game the troops move at half speed normally. They can only move at their full speed if they start in a space that has a character in it. Interesting idea, but it's kind of annoying in that you look at the number that's on your troop and you want to move that distance. I think it would have been better if they'd maybe doubled the troop value if you have a character with you. Now, as I mentioned, there's two different kinds of combat. There are battles and there are sieges. In battles, you have your two stacks of units, and what you do is you break them out. You set aside another part of the table, which is for the battles. And each player goes in turn and places one unit down. So say I initiated the battle, I'll place one unit down. Then my opponent will place one unit across from it. Then my opponent will place one unit down, and I'll place one unit across from it. Then I'll place one unit down, and so on, until you either reach the maximum number of units that you can play in that sort of terrain, or if one player has more units than the other, that player can hold the units in excess as reserves for later on in the battle. So basically, at the start of the battle, there's an equal number of units on each side. In addition to the troop units, then you place your characters behind them, and they will back up individual units. Now, since these troops are lined up in a line, you'd expect that combat is unit to unit, and in fact it is. What happens is, during the battle, each player will roll simultaneously to see what happens, to see whether they hit their opponent. And then each player will roll what's called a morale check to see what actually happens to that unit, assuming that the unit was hit, of course. And the results of the morale check are unit survives, unit is routed, or the unit is simply destroyed. What happens with the routed units is that they basically don't go to the side, and if your side wins the battle, then you get those units back. If you lose the battle, then your opponent gets to capture the units and keep them towards victory points. There are three different kinds of attacks that you can do against your opponent. You can do what's called a magic attack, which is basically a magic missile, and those are performed by any characters that can actually do magic that are involved in the battle. You can do a missile attack, which is arrows, essentially, and you can do a melee attack. And the order is just the order I described. First, you do any magic attacks, resolve any morale, then you do any missile attacks, then you do any melee attacks. The way the magic attacks are resolved is you roll one die. If it's less than or equal to the magic value for the character, then you can do your battle magic attack. For missile and melee attacks, each troop unit has a missile or melee value that you're trying to roll against. And in this case, you're rolling two dice instead of one. Again, if the total of the dice is less than either of these two values, then you succeed in your missile or melee attack. These values can be adjusted by various modifiers, such as leadership from the characters or relative armor. Morale is handled similarly. You get minuses depending on what's going on in the situation. For example, you get a minus one if your opponent has successfully conducted a magic missile attack against you. In this case, you roll one die. If it's less than your morale value, then you succeed your morale and you survive. If it's equal to your morale value, then you're routed, you go to the side, and you wait to see if you're going to be captured or not. If it's greater than your morale value, then the troop is destroyed. There is one option you have during a battle, which is you can withdraw, in which case you have to make morale checks for all your troops, and I believe there's a minus for that as well. And if you survive, and you're the defending player, you can retreat one hex. If you're the attacking player, you can retreat your entire movement, I believe. There is one other option. If you're in a space with a fortress, and the fortress is a friendly fortress, you can choose to retreat to the fortress. In that case, you are now in a siege situation. And sieges are handled a little bit differently. Each time through the siege, the besieger chooses whether they want to siege or invest. In any case, each person rolls two dice and looks up on the appropriate table, either siege or invest, what the result is, depending on who they are. One reason you might want to choose invest if you're the besieger is that it's less likely to damage your troops, but it's also less likely to cause a surrender for the besieged troops, so it's a gamble either way. During the siege phase, you can also cast siege magic, which also gives you pluses on your roll if you have the greatest successful siege magic. Now, I've been talking a fair amount about magic. This is, of course, a fantasy game, so there is a fair amount of magic in the game, beyond just the battle magic and the siege magic. Each side can also cast spells using their characters. So, for example, there is a spell called Vision, which allows you to peek at one stack. And these stacks can get quite huge. Like I mentioned, you can get a battle size of 11. So, being able to peek at the stack is actually a great advantage. This spell can be counteracted immediately by a cloak spell, which is cast by the other player. Another example is Force March, which gives you an extra +2 movement points, so you can move your pieces just a little bit farther. And there are special spells for each side. The Forces of Light have a spell called Light, and the Forces of Darkness have a spell called, well, Darkness. And that will give a -1 morale to the opposing side. Obviously, if you cast both of them, they cancel each other out. The way you cast these spells is by using the characters. As I mentioned, each character has a magic stat associated with them. And again, you roll one die. If the value falls below the magic stat, then you have successfully cast the spell. Certain spells have a minimum number that you have to meet. For example, Vision requires a magic stat of 2 to be able to cast it. Each character also has a range at which they can cast their magic. So, for example, one character might have a range of 6. That means they can only cast, say, Vision at units or unit stacks that are at most 6 spaces away. The only other restriction on magic is that characters can only cast one magic spell per turn. And I believe that includes invocation as well. There are two possible winning conditions for the game. One is you automatically win if you manage to capture your opponent's enemy city. And looking at the way the board is laid out, I would have to say that would be very difficult, or you would be playing for a very long time. The alternative goal, which I think is more likely for most people, is that you score more victory points than your opponent, and the game ends after a randomly determined period of time. One of the reasons I wanted to look at this game is because I hadn't played it in a long time. And in fact, I think when I originally got it, I only played it in a solitaire capacity. Basically sat down, set out both sides, and just kind of played it out for a while. Which, as I understand it, is how 90% of war games are played. But I actually wanted to sit down and play it with somebody else and see how the game felt before I did this report. So I talked my friend Mark Singer into helping me out. It took us about half an hour to set the game up. I think that setup time would go down considerably once you get more familiar with the map and more familiar with all the pieces and where everything's supposed to go. We then went through a couple of movement phases. Mark tried to set up an alliance with the Kingdom of Ula, but it went a bit awry. I don't think I actually mentioned that part. One thing about alliances is that you can either get an alliance, or if things go really wrong, then they'll actually turn on you and form a what's called a semi-permanent alliance with the opponent. And that alliance will last until one of their units gets destroyed during a battle, which they lose. So that's what happened to Mark. He got a bad roll, and suddenly had a semi-permanent alliance with this group, with this neutral group, which was right next to a bunch of his units. So I attacked him. And that gave us a chance to see how the battle stuff would work out. We had about 4 units on each side, and it took a long time to get through the battles. Surprisingly long, considering the number of units that we had. First of all, you have to make your roll just to try to inflict damage on the other player. And then they get to make a morale roll to see if they survive. So it takes quite a while to whittle down your opponent's units. And after a while, I managed to do it. And then we looked up, and we saw that we'd been playing for an hour and a half. That's including setup time. And it was that point we decided that we had done enough, and I concluded that I didn't really miss Hex Encounter war games all that much. I think one of the problems with this game is that the stacks can get so big. I was playing the Demons, and I had that 13-size stack, and I split it in half, and actually I think I moved some of the characters out too, just to try to break it up, but I didn't have any sense of what was in that stack. I suppose I've been spoiled by games like the new War of the Ring with the big plastic pieces, and you can see what each piece is, and yeah, you can stack them up and have little counters there, but you're not going to stack that many there. Now, that sounds like I'm giving a big indictment to the game. I actually thought it was pretty good, generally. I mean, it's a war game. I don't think it would take that long to play once you get familiar with the rules. Although, that is one indictment I do have against the game, that the rules were very hard to follow and not very well laid out. It was kind of difficult to figure out, all right, where's all the movement stuff? Where's all the battle stuff? And the biggest problem was figuring out, all right, how do we do magic? Okay, they mentioned battle magic. What do we do with this? So I would recommend, if you are going to play this game, that you get the rules, read through them thoroughly, and then play a few turns out by yourself before you try to play with somebody else. Often that's true of any game, but I'd say it's particularly true of this game. But overall, if I found someone who was interested in it, I might give the game another chance. It's definitely not a game you could play over lunch at work, but I think you could play it with a friend in an evening. And it wouldn't be a very long evening, too, and you could spend some time chatting and drinking beer and eating pretzels. Not quite a beer and pretzel game, but you get the idea. And it is pretty neat to see a war game in a fantasy setting with magic and all that implies with that. Yeah, I'm aware that Titan is out there, too, and I'll probably do a review of that as well. But this actually feels like, whereas Titan is kind of abstract, this one actually feels like you're playing in a world. I mean, you've got a map there that you can see with mountains and trees and terrain and all that. And it feels a little more grounded in that sense. So I would say, if you like war games, I'd give this one a shot. And if you don't like war games, I really wouldn't take a look at this one. Which, of course, begs the question, where can I get this game? Well, let me talk about that in just a sec. Demon Lord was originally part of a line of games produced by Heritage under the Dwarf Star moniker from 1981 to 1982. And what happened was that Heritage folded soon after, and the game sadly went out of print. There were 8 games. There was one called Barbarian Prince, which is a solitaire game, where you play a prince wandering through a fantasy adventure, gathering party members, and it's all handled through random rolls and a little rulebook. There's a 2-player game called Dragon Rage, where you play either the townspeople who are trying to defend themselves against dragons, or you play the dragons. There's a game called Goblin, where you play either goblin raiders and townspeople trying to defend themselves against the goblins. I believe the idea of Goblin is that the goblin raiders are trying to capture treasure. There's a modified tank game called Grav Armor, which is just hover tanks. There's another 2-player game called Outpost Gamma, which is, if you've ever seen the movie Zulu, that's what Outpost Gamma is. You have 10 armored soldiers who are trying to defend themselves against a lot of very angry aliens. There's Star Smuggler, which is another solitaire game. I don't know that much about Star Smuggler because it's not actually available, which I'll get to in a sec. And then there's Star Viking. One side plays Vikings. The other side plays, I think it's called the Federation. Basically, you've got Viking Raiders versus the Roman Empire or some other major empire, if you like. Now, all of these games, as I said, are out of print. However, they are available, or at least six of them are. You can get them on a website, which I'll link to in my show notes, created by Joseph Scolari. And on that site, they have scans of all the counters. They have rules in either PDF or Word format, scans of the maps, and you can basically just download this stuff, print it out, and play the game. And if you're feeling particularly energetic, you can actually, there's actually instructions on how to do a really nice job of creating clean counters and all that stuff. But I think it's worth checking out. And this game is one of the games available. The only two games that aren't available are Dragon Rage, which I believe the designer, Louis Pulsifer, is trying to get published in a big box format somewhere. And the other one is Star Smuggler, which I think will be available soon. At least there was a posting on BoardGameGeek indicating that sometime early this year it will be available. So which ones of those would I recommend? Well, honestly, the only one I've played is Demon Lord, so that's the only one I can make a confident recommendation on. I am interested in checking out Barbarian Prince, simply because it is A, a solitaire game, and B, it looks like an interesting concept. I'm also interested in checking out Star Smuggler when that comes out. I've heard a lot of good things about that one, and of all the listings on BoardGameGeek, I believe Star Smuggler is the second highest. Dragon Rage is the highest, and of course I'll be looking for that when it comes out, assuming it does. And as I look at the time, I notice that I am running way long here. So much for my 20 minutes, huh? All right, well, I guess that'll wrap it up for today. The Vintage Gamer is a podcast produced weekly and available for direct download or RSS at www.thevintagegamer.net. The music for The Vintage Gamer is provided by Magnatune.com and is available on their album Music of the Spheres. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. You can contact me via email at vintagejim@gmail.com or via Skype. My username there is JVSquare. Thank you for listening.